Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and happy President's Day. To refresh your memory, here they are.
Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Quincy Adams, Jackson, McMurrin, Harrison, Tyler, Polk, and Taylor, Fillmore, Pierce, Buchanan, Lincoln, Johnson, Grant, and Hayes, Garfield, Arthur, Cleveland, Harrison, Cleveland, McKinley, Roosevelt, Taft, Wilson, Harding, Coolidge, Hoover,
Why didn't I ever learn that song? That's the way to remember them. Well, this is President's Day, and historians are frequently asked to rank the best presidents. This being a special day, we asked a prominent historian to do the same, and we'll ask you to do the same. Not only might this be a fun hour, for me it'll be an extraordinary fun hour, but it will prompt discussion about what qualities make for great leaders. In the late 1940s, Arthur Schlesinger polled 55 historians in a survey for Life magazine on who were the best presidents. He did another poll in 1962, and over the years there have been all kinds of polls. Most show that there are a small number of presidents who always rank at the top: Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The general public tends to give different rankings, with more recent presidents closer to the top, so Ronald Reagan has polled high among the general public, and living presidents may move up the ladder as time goes by. Since 2000, historians have consistently ranked five presidents in the top tier: George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, FDR, and Theodore Roosevelt. The opinion of our guest this hour, the best presidents were Lincoln and FDR, but he says that some white Southerners would disagree strenuously about Abe, and most conservatives would dislike Roosevelt. Michael Kazin is our guest this hour, professor of history at Georgetown University, co-editor of Dissent magazine, author of American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. He's written other books as well, including A Godly Hero, The Life of William Jennings Bryan. That sounds interesting. I should read that. And The Populist Persuasion and American History. We are asking you this hour, and it should be fun, so please play with us, you know, think with us. Think in your mind the top three or the top five presidents of the United States, and you can briefly make your case of why you think so-and-so is number one and so-and-so is number two or number three. Our phone number this hour, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that is @KDunnShow. Professor Michael Kazin, happy President's Day, and thank you so much for being with us.
It's great to be here, Kathleen.
Yeah, I love talking about the presidents. I had never heard that little song before because I can never remember them, and there are certain ones I can never remember what they did. That big bunch kind of in the middle, and I should study them at some point. But that's a way to remember them, right? Put a little song together?
Yeah, I never heard that song, actually. I think go through them pretty well. Once in a while, I miss one in the late 19th century, some of those bearded ones, the Harrison.
Some of the bearded ones.
Hazes, the ones who actually didn't really matter too much.
So. Yeah, exactly. So we can take a few off the list. So as far as you're concerned, and I would have to agree with you, I'm a huge Lincoln fan, so I'd put Lincoln number one and probably FDR number two. And you put them within number one and two as well, Lincoln and FDR.
Yeah, I mean, both of them followed a failed president, Buchanan, for Lincoln. Buchanan, who, for constitutional reasons and probably psychological reasons too, just was unable to try to get the warring states together to keep the Union together. And then with Hoover, of course, he took power as a very popular president when he won election in 1928. But then the Great Depression happened. He was perceived as someone who couldn't do anything about that. He also tried to uphold Prohibition, which was becoming more and more unpopular. And so both Lincoln and Roosevelt came into power at a time of crisis, And they, in many ways, solved that crisis, not all by themselves, of course, but they were the leaders who were in power at the time when the crisis was solved. And also personally, both of them sort of had a commanding presence. They both were great orators.
Yes.
And that, of course, matters, too.
Yeah. And I think that that may influence me in Lincoln's direction when I look at, I mean, he's been called, and I think it's probably legitimate, one of our finest writers of that entire century. What he, the words he wrote are so important and so beautiful, I always read them out loud.
Yeah, of course, if you go to the Lincoln Memorial here in Washington, you go to, you know, inside the memorial, you see that gargantuan statue of him, of course, which looms over everything. But on both walls, on one wall, there's the Gettysburg Address, which is carved into that piece of marble. On the other wall, there's the second inaugural address, which is, I think, probably the greatest inaugural address ever given by a president. And it's hard to imagine, hard to think of other presidents who you'd want to memorialize in that way.
Mm-hmm. When you think about presidents, and maybe this would put we'd have to have a different kind of polling here, but when I think about Lincoln, I think about, and FDR for that matter, people who have grown in the job, people who have made the presidency bigger, people who had to respond to horrendous times in America and had to fashion what their thoughts and what the action would be to, in Lincoln's case, hold a nation together. Who do you think grew the most?
Well, in some ways, John Kennedy certainly did. He only had days, as we know. But he took office as somebody who really just wanted to focus on foreign affairs. And one of the first things that happened to Kennedy was the Bay of Pigs invasion, which he had not planned. That had been planned under Eisenhower, his predecessor. But this was a real black eye for the president and for the United States generally. And then the Cuban Missile Crisis took place, which almost embroiled the world in nuclear war. And but then, gradually but surely, he understood that the Black Freedom Movement, which was primarily taking place in the South, was posing a moral dilemma for Democrats, whose main support for a long time had been in the White South. And so he in the last year of his life, really broke with that racist tradition of the party and began to stand up for a civil rights bill and propose a civil rights bill to Congress. And that didn't get passed until after he was assassinated in 1964, but I think he had not come into office expecting to be the civil rights president that he became.
Mm-hmm. And certainly LBJ, though we remember him for the horrible conduct in Vietnam, we also need to remember that he truly was a civil rights president. And the number of pieces of legislation passed in just a couple-year period when he was president is phenomenal.
Yes, of course. But, of course, then, you know, you have to, of course, recognize, as I'm sure you know, your listeners know, that a president, you know, doesn't do things by himself. the only reason, well, not the only reason, but the main reason, I think, why Johnson was able to accomplish as much as he was able to accomplish is his party had a huge majority in both houses of Congress, something that, for example, Barack Obama hasn't enjoyed. And also he came into office after the liberal predecessor was seen as a martyr, John Kennedy, to some of his ideas. So, in many ways, Johnson could ride the crest of both the Kennedy image and also having this tremendous majority after he won in 1964, a landslide election. So, you know, as Lincoln said famously, events control the president more than the president controls events. And that certainly was true for LBJ.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about presidents whose image may get better as time goes by. You wrote a piece for The New Republic a while ago saying that President Obama will have a better chance of buffering his historical reputation if he returns to the bold stance he promised during the 2008 campaign and largely stuck by until the midterm election. Amplify on that, please.
Well, he's trying to do that now. I mean, as we know, Obama had a pretty good first 2 years, at least in terms of getting a lot of legislation passed that he wanted. Of course, Obamacare is the most well-known of those, but the stimulus plan, the Dodd-Frank regulation of Wall Street plan, there are several others as well. But he did not really build on his popularity in many ways because of the fierce partisanship of Congress. He lost popularity. He was seen as responsible for that, whether or not that's true. And so after 2010, after the Republicans took back control of Congress, at least of the House, and then, of course, this last year took control of the Senate as well, you know, there's not a whole lot he could really get accomplished. And so I think he sort of gradually understood that and understands that now. And so with the help of a somewhat improved economy, he's beginning to really speak more like the liberal visionary he did campaign as in 2008. Whether or not how that will look in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, of course, it's impossible to know. Depends what happens in the intervening years. But at least he's coming on more now like the kind of visionary liberal that many people wanted to be, who was his core supporters.
And Professor Kazin, what is it that goes through the minds of historians to reexamine the record of a president and either move him up or down?
Yeah, well, you know, something of a crapshoot, of course. As you said in your introduction there, it's you get 10 presidents together, you'll get 10 different lists of who their favorite presidents are. A lot depends, as I mentioned before, on, you know, whether the main ideas, the main accomplishments of a particular president are seen as having endured and are built upon by successive by presidents later on. I mean, after all, FDR was a very embattled president in many ways, especially right before World War II when he was losing popularity and the Democrats were about to lose Congress. But because he led the U.S. in the greatest war in history and success in the greatest war in history, World War II, and because most of the programs passed in the New Deal are still with us and are, for the most part, pretty popular, his ranking among historians has continued to go up and is always at the top. Whereas a president like, let's say, Andrew Jackson, who was a very strong president at the time, because he was a president and a defender of slavery, doesn't look so good in the 21st century.
I was interested in your comments about FDR, that the coming of World War II saved him from having to govern during a long recession, and you say it may well have defeated him in his bid for a third term in 1940.
Right, right. Well, you know, there was what was called the Roosevelt Recession. It took place in 1937 and 1938, and Republicans made big gains in 38 midterm election. And nobody had ever won a third term for the presidency. Hardly anybody had ever even tried to run for a third term. And so it was very controversial at the time, and a lot of people thought that alone would defeat him. But tradition in the end didn't matter so much when there was a war raging in Europe and another one in Asia, and Americans wanted, a majority of Americans anyway, wanted to elect somebody who they felt safe about, rather than a newcomer like Wendell Willkie, who ran against him.
Mm-hmm. It is when you think of people, or when I think of people, who have taken that office and done everything they could possibly do with it. You think of FDR, don't you? Think of him up all night. He's got a war to deal with. He's got these incredible social programs. He's got all these people out of work. He's just coming up with idea after idea and then figuring out how to get it passed. He just took that job and made it a huge job.
Yeah, and also he was smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day and drinking
right.
martinis before dinner, which, together with his disability, ended up killing him at a fairly young age.
Yeah.
You know.
We're going to welcome phone calls. The question, of course, of the hour on this President's Day is the most important president in U.S. history. Michael Kazin is our guest. He's a professor of history at Georgetown University, co-editor of Dissent magazine. We asked him, of course, to weigh in on this, and he said that, in his opinion, the best presidents were Lincoln and FDR. But, of course, you might disagree if your political persuasion is different or if you lived in a different part of the country. You may not put Abe Lincoln at number one, right? What do you think? We'd love to hear from you. So let's get involved in a perfect President's Day activity, as far as I'm concerned. It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. A few people have already left messages on Facebook. Those would be great fun to read during this day. The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, Bob Habish will be joining us, and a person who's well-known as a writer in Milwaukee will also be with us. There's a book that Kurt Chandler has written that is about Robert Habish, Courtroom Avenger, The Challenges and Triumphs of Robert Habish, a name that will be very familiar to those of you who live in Wisconsin. He is considered one of the top trial lawyers in the United States and was a pioneer in developing products liability law. So some of the cases, which are outlined in detail, are fascinating. His courtroom style, why he decided to go into this kind of law. They will both be with us tomorrow during the 2 o'clock hour, and it should be extremely interesting to focus on the cases that he has handled. He's still practicing law, and how he rose to the top of his profession, and what kinds of changes were made in terms of the very construction of certain products to keep them from being harmful to people. All right, let's go to phone calls. The best presidents of the United States. That's what we're talking about this hour of the program. Michael Kazin is our guest, professor of history at Georgetown University. And let's go to Kathleen in Waukesha first. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. I am fascinated with anything historical, and I've got some very quick comments. I think my favorites would be, of course, agreeing pretty much Washington, Franklin Roosevelt with Abraham Lincoln and Kennedy, and how they impacted the changes in our lives. But part of it is how they relied on other people, and Kennedy ultimately changed my life in a personal way because he listened to Hubert Humphrey from Minnesota and Henry Royce from Wisconsin and created Peace Corps, of which I was, and it totally changed my personal life. But Abraham Lincoln, and you had Ken Burns on a while back. Ken Burns has got a project called The Address, and he made a documentary film about it. And I teach acting and theater to children between ages 3 and 99, and I require that all of my students, even the 3-year-olds, start trying to memorize it and that they videotape it and try to send it on. And I understand that Ms. Dunn and the wonderful, wonderful Mr. K.P. Whaley have also recorded their own version of the Gettysburg Address.
We did.
And after having been a Peace Corps volunteer in Africa, I immediately came home and started doing foster care and never had a white child. So and I was a protester back in the days of protesting for civil rights and against closed housing and all those sorts of things. So Kennedy affected my total life because he listened to Henry Royce from Milwaukee.
Yeah, that's right. It was Henry Royce's idea. Thanks, Kathleen, very much. In a personal way, that is true about JFK. If you grew up in that time, you thought about public service. A lot of people did. It's amazing how many politicians or people who are in the high echelons of public service in this country are former Peace Corps volunteers. Michael.
Yeah, that's true. And you know, what Kathleen underlines, I think, is important, that prisons can be important as catalysts, I think, in starting something that they don't really see to fruition. After all, Kennedy was killed, you know, only 3 years, more than 3 years after he took power. And but the idea, the image of him as someone who wants people to get involved in public service, the image of him as someone who wants America to stand for something good in the world as well as dominating the world, you know, sort of the core of what we still think of as a liberal vision, which liberals from, you know, Henry Royce to Barack Obama still try to embody. You know, that is as important as what he actually accomplished during his administration, which most historians would argue was not a lot, really, in part because he didn't have a large majority of people behind him in Congress, but also because he didn't have time, and he was, as I said before, was mostly concerned with foreign affairs, not domestic.
Thanks, Kathleen. Frank in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, thanks for another wonderful program, Kathleen. You do a terrific job with the history. I go along with Lincoln and FDR at the top, but I think my list is kind of liberal bias modern, but I would say LBJ, Kennedy, and Teddy Roosevelt. And all these guys had something in common. They used the government to help the regular people. And I think that's what separates presidents in history. And people don't understand. I keep saying this, and people don't get this. Kennedy's death caused a great majority of Democrats to come in in 1964. Not that they were thinking Kennedy when they passed all of that legislation. In fact, the Civil Rights Act of 64 was passed in July of 64. But his death caused that plethora of voting rights and open and all those wonderful liberal laws that came in and helped the American people, the food stamps, open housing, was a result of Kennedy's majority that came in 64. And people don't get that. But thank you for taking my call.
Thank you very much, Frank. Professor Kazin.
Yeah, you know, of course that's true. But you know, we shouldn't forget, those who've seen the film Selma know about this, that there was a huge movement led by black people, but of black and white people and people from other races too, who believed it was time finally to get away from to abolish the segregationist laws that had been with us for hundreds of years. So, you know, I think it's important that presidents have to respond to popular pressure, and do respond to popular pressure if it's strong enough, and they believe in a very practical way can also help them. And that's something which LBJ struggled with. He understood that, as the caller probably knows, that he had to get behind the Civil Rights Bill. It was imperative. He couldn't deny what the majority of people in his party who had supported him and supported Kennedy wanted. On the other hand, he understood, as he said to one of his advisors, that by signing the civil rights law, he probably lost the white South for generations, and that turned out to be true.
Mm-hmm. Your assessment of Teddy Roosevelt?
Well, as you know, he came into power just like Johnson after his predecessor had been assassinated, in this case William McKinley. He was really at war, unlike LBJ, he was really at war with many of the leaders of his party, the Republican Party, during his presidency. He was a progressive, in modern terms a liberal, about the power of government. He was more supportive of labor unions than Republicans usually had been, for example. But he was a conservationist, as we know, famously friends with John Muir, the great environmentalist. But the leaders of the Republican Party were much more conservative, and he battled with them really throughout both the rest of McKinley's term, and also when he won his own election as president in 1904. So again, his image is in many ways, like Kennedy's, larger than what he actually was able to accomplish.
Jan on Facebook says, George Washington was the greatest. I'm convinced no one rises above his excellent leadership when the new Constitution was in its infancy. That said, Franklin Roosevelt is my personal favorite. FDR rallied a dispirited population to give them hope and deliver on the promises which gave them hope.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting about Washington. People, of course, want to see him as a great president because he was the first, and he helped to define the office in many ways. But you have to remember what a small federal government there was under Washington. I mean, I think probably the city of Milwaukee has a larger budget, even accounting for inflation, than the federal budget, than the whole federal government did when Washington was president. He, in effect, was mayor of Washington, D.C., with some potential powers beyond that, but he didn't really have cause to use them very much.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number, please join us on this President's Day. We're talking about having you answer the question as well. Who do you think were the best American presidents, and why do you think so? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And our guest this hour, if you're just tuning in, is Professor Michael Kazin. He's professor of history at Georgetown University, co-editor of Dissent magazine, and author of American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. It's interesting how a person may have done worthwhile things, and I'm thinking of Richard Nixon, who did some pretty interesting things when he was in office that we tend to forget about, and yet the administration was so rocked by scandal that's how he will forever be remembered by most in American history.
Yes, he was his own worst enemy, as we know. He was a very insecure man, and he never really thought that he got the kind of support and respect that he deserved, even after he won re-election by a landslide in 1972. He still continued to be paranoid about one or two anti-war demonstrators he saw in Lafayette Park across from the White House. So one of the things strong presidents have to be is secure in their own power, secure in their own, and confident that when they make it an important decision that the public will be behind them. Even if it's not going to be behind them, they have to believe it will be behind them. And, and I think Nixon really never believed that, actually, and that helped to bring him down. Besides the fact, of course, he was governing at a time of crisis. He came into office when there were almost 500,000 American troops in Vietnam, and he was faced with a decision what to do about that. He did begin to take American troops out of Vietnam, though the number of Vietnamese who died during his administration was greater than it was under Johnson and Kennedy. But I think he's an example of someone with tremendous talents, a really great politician, not particularly charismatic the way Kennedy was or the way FDR was, but someone who was quite talented, brilliant in many ways, but who could not manage himself. And that, in the end, brought him down.
Jim is next in Waukesha. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Kathleen, how are you doing?
Good.
My question is, why do so many folks think Ronald Reagan is a great president? I'd like to add my opinion. I don't think he was a very good president. He ran up huge deficits, and he basically caused the beginning of the downfall of labor unions in this country. So I wonder if the guest could explain to me why some folks on one particular side of the aisle think Ronald Reagan is such a...
And Jim, if you don't mind my asking, who do you admire?
Well, my two favorite presidents are Lincoln and Harry Truman.
Interesting. Professor Kazin.
Well, clearly, as I said before, and we all know, greatness is in the eye of the beholder, in the eye of the ideological beholder, if you will. And if you like, if you're conservative, then you see Ronald Reagan as the Republican FDR, really. Someone who sort of defined his party, or redefined his party, and after whom all Republicans sort of model themselves. So, or try to model themselves. I mean, everyone wants to be the next Reagan. Everyone since Reagan left office who runs for president as a Republican, just as every Democrat who ran for president after FDR wanted to be more like FDR, including Obama.
Mm-hmm.
In one way, Reagan was similar to Lincoln and FDR in the sense that he came into office after what was perceived as a failed presidency and during a time of crisis. Jimmy Carter, of course, under his presidency, inflation went up, the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, and a lot of Americans thought there should be some aggressive response to that. The economy was doing badly. The U.S. wasn't looking good overseas. We were still in this sort of post-Vietnam syndrome where a lot of people thought America was in decline. And so for a lot of people, a lot of Americans, not just conservatives, Reagan seemed as if he was reasserting American strength, confidence. The economy gradually began to get better, though it didn't at first while he was president. And of course, he was fortunate too. Like any great president has to be fortunate to a degree, because the Soviet Union was beginning to fall apart in the 1980s. If anybody sees that great series of The Americans that's on TV now,
I have seen it. Yes.
Yeah, about these two Russian spies who sort of spend years in the United States. You know, the 1980s was not a good time if you were in the Soviet Union or if you were pro-Soviet, and Reagan was able to take advantage of that by rallying a lot of Americans around the idea that America was back, you know,
mm-hmm.
again. And so I think that's very important. And look, conservatives have been a very powerful movement, have had a very powerful movement over the last 40 to 50 years. And Reagan is sort of a symbol of that movement in the same way that FDR was a symbol of the progressive movement in this time.
Mm. Jim mentioned Truman as one of his favorites. Let's go to Charlie in Milwaukee, who I think would agree with Jim. Charlie?
Hi, thank you. My reason for Harry Truman is that he always seemed to be a straight shooter in what he told the public. And the question that I had for your guest is that in the movie Lincoln, they talked about President Lincoln lying to Congress to get the amendment passed. You had FDR telling Americans that he wasn't going to pursue a foreign war, yet at the same time, behind the scenes, was actually promoting things to bring America into World War II. And then, like recently with President Obama, his signature health plan, the economist from MIT says, was involved with a lot of deception. Does presidential honesty affect their greatness? Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Charlie.
If it did, we wouldn't have any great America presidents, because all presidents bend the truth, let's put it that way. They don't necessarily outright lie, though some certainly have. Nixon certainly did. But they bend the truth. And Churchill talked about this, about, you know, the greater truth being defended by a bodyguard of lies. I mean, being a powerful person, especially as the United States got more powerful, the president got more powerful as well, you know, there's a lot of times when things are going on, plans are afoot, that the president feels like he has to shield that from the American people. So I don't want to sound too cynical. You know, I love American politics. I believe political change is possible, and we need good presidents, good moral presidents to help that process along. On the other hand, you know, this is how politics works, especially at the highest levels. And especially when we have a strong national security state, which we do, it depends a lot on deception. And the United States has been at war through most of its history, one way or the other, actually. And a fact most people don't appreciate. And wars tend to promote deception.
And we go to Eric next in Madison. Hi, Eric.
Hi. I would like to talk about Selma. Selma was a good movie, but in 1862, in a newspaper in Selma, they were collecting money for the assassination of Lincoln. And I like Lincoln because he suffered so much as a child, and also suffered greatly in his marriage. His heart was so big that he understood the working class people. He put the workers before capital, and he did. And because of his Congress didn't have the South, they were able to pass the land grant, university colleges, and stuff like that. So my vote is for Lincoln.
He was, when you look at the personal story, just the personal history, he has to have been the most profoundly interesting person to have achieved the presidency, I think. But my color may be shaded a little bit, Professor Casey.
Yeah, well, obviously, as you know, he grew up fairly poor. He was a self-made man. But that's true of other presidents whose image is not as great, like Herbert Hoover. Grew up on a farm and went to a Quaker school and then to Stanford and really made himself into a millionaire. He was a great engineer. He was known for that. So there's a lot of great stories out there. I think Lincoln's, because of what Lincoln did as president, people began to look at his childhood and his upbringing and his rise to the presidency as something almost God-given, so to speak, almost something which that he was almost like a secular saint.
Thank you, Eric, for your call. Mitch in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to ask him about people that have changed the history, such as around Ronald Reagan. He had a picture where he was shaking hands with John Wayne Gacy, and now you can't find that picture anywhere.
Yeah, I don't know about that picture. I can't comment on that. I didn't know that picture was taken. Of course, Reagan also believed that he had, well, he said that he had liberated the concentration camps.
Right.
When he had not been anywhere near them at the time. So lots of things get changed in memory.
Yeah. Patricia on Facebook writes, several years ago I had my 7th grade students interview seniors in our community who lived during the Depression, including my mother. Almost every person said FDR was his or her favorite president. As this generation passes, do you think FDR will continue to be so admired?
That's an excellent question. I mean, historians talk a lot about the history of memory, how memories change and how those memories change what we understand really happened. You know, a lot depends, again, on whether the basic New Deal programs passed, the basic sense that government should be, as one of your callers said, helping ordinary people, or whether government should stay out of that and the free market should reign. A lot depends on whether we continue to cherish that tradition or not. I think we probably will. I don't think it's possible, and here's my politics showing, I don't think it's possible to have a strong country without a strong, caring government. But that might not be true. We'll have to see.
Michael Kazin is our guest this hour, this President's Day, and we're ranking the best U.S. presidents. and determining why they have achieved the rank of best. He's a professor of history, Georgetown University, co-editor of Dissent magazine, author of American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Hero, also changed a nation, rather, also a godly hero, the life of William Jennings Bryan, and he's written other books as well. So who do you put at the top and why, or close to the top? 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Mike is next in Milwaukee. Hello, Mike.
Hi. My big question for our historian there, growing up and all, I always heard great praise for President Lincoln and how by having and winning the Civil War, we kept the country together. And aside from the fact that we eventually got to free the slaves through the 13th Amendment and all that, which actually was not a purpose at the war originally, how does he think, does he rate the actual value of keeping the country together, this great Lincoln accomplishment, compared to the actual cost? Was it worth it?
It's a great question, you know. Well, you know, it depends whether you think it's important to have a large, strong nation that you're part of. I think the United States, of course, has accomplished a great deal. You know, I think I love my country, and I would hate it to have a different country, especially one with slavery as part of its system in 11 states in the South, which would have been true at least for several decades if the South had won the Civil War. So, in the end, the task of uniting the nation, of fighting to unite the nation, is inseparable from the task of defeating slavery. As you know, that wasn't what Lincoln said the war was about at the beginning. It was only keeping the nation united. But clearly the war wouldn't have happened if there hadn't been this tremendous disagreement about whether slavery could expand into the territories. And that by 2 years after the war began, became really a war of necessity for freeing the slaves. So in order to keep the nation together, in order to free the slaves, you had to keep the nation together. Because if you didn't keep the nation together, sorry, my cell phone's coming off.
Oh, it's okay. Sorry, he can't talk right now. He's on the radio.
I got it.
It's okay.
Right, let me continue. Civil War was a war about slavery, and so in order to keep the United Nations one nation, to force the South back into the Union, slavery had to be abolished, and that meant that you had to have the North win the Civil War. So if Lincoln had said to the South, okay, secede, we don't care, form your own nation, maybe we'll have trade relations with you at some point, that would have meant the perpetuation of slavery, which I think was a moral evil, as we all pretty much do today, I hope. And so that's why it was important to keep the nation together. That's why it was important to fight the Civil War. And the South felt so strongly about keeping slavery that they were willing to keep fighting until much of the South was ruined by the war.
Yeah. Asman sends this email. I came to the U.S. from Bosnia as a refugee and had to learn about American history to be able to pass the U.S. citizen test. I think Washington is number one, then Lincoln, then number three, Bill Clinton. Washington and Lincoln did amazing jobs for America and the people. Clinton did good things for the economy and helped stop the war in the Balkans.
Well, he's got to write his own opinion. I think Clinton was in some ways like an Eisenhower in the sense that he didn't change a lot. He didn't do anything to damage the country. He was, as we know, a very controversial president, unlike Eisenhower. But he was someone who was able, I think, to take advantage of the times in which he was running things. He was able to take advantage of the beginnings of the dot-com economy. He was able to take advantage of the fact that the Cold War was over, which actually happened under George H.W. Bush's administration. So he did no harm, let's put it that way, no great harm.
However, you know, you could say if you have a certain point of view that he also didn't see the growth of Al-Qaeda and the possibility that Al-Qaeda would be organized to attack the United States. So some would argue that he should have foreseen the rise of an Islamicist terrorist organization like that and done something about it before they got strong enough and equipped enough to attack the United States.
Joanne is next in Jacksonport. Hi.
Hi. I'm having trouble recalling all the details of that good series on PBS about Teddy Roosevelt. But I think that there were some really interesting things he did, considering he came from such a conservative Republican family. And he started, of course, we all know what he did for national parks. And I think he started some kind of antitrust things as well. He was certainly not anything for integration, but I recall something about his recognition of the plight of some of the laborers of the time. And I think there were some other things, too. So it's really difficult. Some of these that were flawed in some ways accomplished some really great things.
Professor Kazin.
Yes, in terms of labor, he was really the first president, Teddy Roosevelt was, to step into a strike and settle it and really sided, for the most part, with the unions. So this was the anthracite coal strike of 1902. Coal, of course, was the major source of energy for American homes and factories at the time. And he saw that the owners of the coal mines in Pennsylvania, where anthracite was mined, really didn't want to deal with the unions at all, were refusing to deal with the unions, thought the unions were completely illegitimate institutions. And he, in effect, forced them to recognize that the large majority of coal miners wanted to be represented by the union. And after the strike was over, that, in fact, happened. So that was very important. It was a sort of a precedent that Franklin Roosevelt later on built on.
And we go next to Sandra in Racine. Hi, Sandra.
Hi. I'm agreeing with a lot of what people are saying, but I'd like to give some kudos to President Obama because he keeps plugging away thoughtfully despite having to deal with people who have openly said, our mission is for you to fail. So, boy, I would feel awful in that situation, and he has continued to do what he can, and I feel like he's done a lot, and history will show that, and to know that our country still hasn't gotten over the separation of races and things like that. So,
thanks, Sandra.
Anyway, kudos to President Obama.
All right, thanks for the call.
I feel much the same way. Obviously, the first black president was not going to sweep all before him. And, you know, when you take office, as Obama did, really still at the beginning of the Great Recession, as opposed to when, say, Franklin Roosevelt took power almost 3 years after the Great Depression had begun, he was going to be blamed, rightly or wrongly, for the continuing downturn of the economy and the continuing stagnation of the economy today, even for as most people experience it. So, again, as with Lincoln, he's the captive of events. And also, Republicans, I think, after Reagan, sort of believed that the White House was kind of theirs, you know, that they were the natural party of the presidency, the way Democrats used to believe, actually, when Franklin Roosevelt and then Truman and then Kennedy were elected and Johnson were elected. So I think that's also one of the things which is operating here. And something we haven't really talked about, but great presidents usually are presidents who increase the power of not just the office, but the power of government, federal government itself. And as we all know, the power, increase the power of the federal government for whatever purpose is very controversial today. It wasn't as much in the 1930s, wasn't as much in the 1960s, wasn't as much during the Civil War, when, of course, there was a war to keep the country together and only the federal government could do that. So I think that's one of the things that's operating now as well. And in 20, 30 years, we might see Obama as having sort of preserved a sense that the government was had to be strong enough to do what a lot of people wanted to do. Or if conservatives triumph, we might see Obama as another Herbert Hoover.
Mm. Thanks, Sandra, very much for your call. Josie in Sheboygan. Hi.
Yes. My favorite was Abraham Lincoln, and also my birthday is on his birthday.
Wow.
So I just had a birthday, and I think the worst president was George W. Bush because of the Patriot Act, torture, the NSA, the invasion of Iraq, the lying and all that. And also I'd like to agree with that lady about President Obama, and also I think President Carter has gotten short shrift all these years. I mean, he was ridiculed by Reagan because he wore a sweater and they tore apart the those solar panels or something that they had at the White House. So I think, and then Reagan said, "Oh, a tree is a tree is a tree," or some stupid remark like that. So I don't care for Reagan either. And also Iran-Contra, did everybody remember that? So that's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Josie, for your comments. Professor?
Well, it's very hard for one-term president, the way Carter was, to be perceived as a success. We think of the least popular presidents, the presidents who historians and most of the public thinks were not very successful presidents. In almost every case, there were one-term presidents. Buchanan and Andrew Johnson, who wasn't even elected, and Gerald Ford, who wasn't elected either, and, of course, George H.W. Bush, though his reputation is coming up a little bit more recently, Carter. So the very fact that a majority of the electorate rejected him when he tried to be reelected makes it very difficult to, I think, for historians and also most Americans to appreciate some of what he did. I think, again, his intentions were admirable, but his execution was not so admirable. And part of what he did too was he was a fairly conservative Democrat at a time when the Democratic Party was still very liberal, and so in some ways he was at war with a lot of his party. As people probably remember, Teddy Kennedy ran against him for the nomination in 1980, and even though he didn't get the nomination, Carter got the nomination, a lot of Democrats were very sour about Carter by the time he left office. And that's something that great presidents have to be great politicians as well. And if you divide your own party, it's going to be very difficult to get a lot done.
Hmm. You, in writing about one of Abraham Lincoln's famous sayings, and God knows he had so many of them, you write about as the presidency grew more imperial in its reach, the presidents themselves have increasingly fallen prey to the arrogance of power. They might have paid heed to Lincoln's famous caution, which he gave near the end of the Civil War. I claim to have controlled events, but confess plainly that events have controlled me. Does a president really, though, need to do both?
Yeah, of course. I mean, presidents have to have a very keen understanding of what's going on in the world and what their power can do about that, and also a keen sense of the limits of that power, as mm-hmm. I think Lincoln had. I mean, after all, Lincoln was always opposed to slavery, for example, but it wasn't until the Union won this great victory at Antietam in the fall of 1862, that he felt confident enough to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. And that was also done in part to make sure that the British wouldn't side with the Confederacy, which they were about to do at one point that year. So you have to have a keen understanding of what's going on in the world, but you also have to realize that there's only so much you can do at a certain point. The president's not the king of the world. Some presidents would like to be the king of the world, but it's a good thing they're not, I think, in a democratic nation and an increasingly democratic world. And also, when they think that they can do more than they can really do, the way George W. Bush did, I think, in the Iraq War, they usually sow the seeds of their own line.
Thanks, Josie, for your call. Dennis in Middleton. Hi.
Yeah, I just want to know your opinion when you compare George W. Bush to Barack Obama and the level of trust that Americans put in him, which would you say was the more effective of the Illuminati puppets running the nation?
I'm not sure where you're going with that. Let's go to
I think I know what he means by that. There's a certain conspiracy about the Illuminati, a secret group that was founded during the French Revolution and some people believe runs the world. But
yeah.
Well, I don't agree.
All right, let's move on. Tyler in Appleton. Hi.
Hi there. I know that Clinton was kind of given a tag of
stay the course in the last discussion about him, but I do want to bring up the point that in the modern era of politics, yes, the Cold War faded with George W. Bush, but there hasn't really been a meaningful war since Vietnam. The Cold War was fading and all that. And you have, you talk about Clinton stayed the course and benefacted off his time. Yeah, but you can't really look at a president from Carter forward and say they were a phenomenal success. When we have the red and the blue fractioning the way it is in this country and we're pulling apart a bell curve, Clinton was the great negotiator from the South Democrat who kept it together and actually made policy go forward. So I think he's horribly underappreciated.
All right. Thank you for your call. I'm sorry we can't get a response. I was having such a good time I forgot what time it was. We have to say goodbye. Professor Michael Kazin, thank you very much for celebrating President's Day with us today. It was great fun and informative. Thank you.
Thanks. I really enjoyed it.
Good. Join us again then. Professor Michael Kazin, he's a professor of history at Georgetown University, co-editor of Dissent magazine, author of American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. He's also author of A Godly Hero, The Life of William Jennings Bryan. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this show, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee.